From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we'll get some context to this week's release of documents related to the sexual abuse cases in the Milwaukee Catholic Church.
I think it makes a difference for the victims and survivors and their families that the public can know what happened to them and why it is that they can't, quote unquote, just get over it.
Later, Melinda Myers talks about balancing beauty and abundance in the garden. Our look back at Wisconsin soldiers at Gettysburg continues. And writer Tom Held shares his perspective on the region's top trails.
Wisconsin right now ranks third in the country in the total miles, over 2,000 miles of rail corridors that have been converted into multi-use trails.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. People in and out of the Catholic Church are still trying to assess the long-term impact of the scores of documents released by the Milwaukee Archdiocese this week. The documents brought to light many instances of sexual abuse committed by Catholic priests and what measures, if any, the church took as those allegations were first brought forward. They also show then-Archbishop Timothy Dolan requested the church transfer $57 million to the Diocesan Cemetery Fund so the money couldn't be tapped into by victims seeking compensation. The New York Times reported that Dolan says these were parish, not archdiocesan funds. But advocates for victims of sexual abuse, such as Peter Isley of Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, seized on the revelation as a smoking gun.
Cardinal Timothy Dolan, when he was here in Milwaukee, who was to be the pastor and shepherd of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, and especially to victims of childhood sexual abuse, to whom he made to us direct promises that he was going to be truthful, and that he was going to bring healing to this archdiocese. Today's document, especially the letter he wrote to the Vatican, proves that he set up the cemetery trust, the so-called cemetery trust, to shield those assets from victim survivors, and in doing so, committed fraud. And he should be under federal investigation. We'll be emailing a letter today to the federal prosecutor.
Marie Rohde is a longtime religion writer who covered the latest chapter in the sexual abuse story within the Milwaukee Catholic Church for the National Catholic Reporter. She joins us in the studio to add some detail to the story. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
In the context of everything that has come to this point, what do you see as the most significant aspect to the release of these documents this week?
Well, that's a little hard to say because I personally didn't find anything in it particularly startling. I mean, it was, I don't think we were led to believe by Archbishop Listecki's letter that some Catholics, it might shake their faith. It would be prepared to be scandalized or whatever the term was that he used. I think you'd have to have been living in a cave not to realize that a lot of this was going on. I mean, there were a couple that were new. I don't think Daniel Budzinski, who was a pretty notorious pedophile, apparently we were not aware of his case. That had not come out previously. We were aware that money had been transferred to the cemetery fund, but exactly why that was done had not really come out until the Snap called it the smoking gun.
Well, right. So let me get your take on that. The people that are using the term smoking gun to describe this is the revelation that Archbishop Dolan had $57 million transferred to the cemetery fund, essentially to protect that money from liability concerns. Would you use the term smoking gun?
Probably not, but I think it was certainly a key piece of evidence that we had not seen before. And the Archdiocese had said, well, that money was always in the general fund and it was intended for the use of. But in the letter, he specifically says that it would protect the money. And I guess I've never seen – how much do they need to take care of cemeteries for the rest of time? I don't know.
Well, what do you make of Dolan's statement regarding the money's transfer? And he also wrapped it into this idea that the church has this ongoing responsibility to provide health care and other services to priests even after they've been removed from the priesthood.
I think that's his perspective on it, and I think that the victims have just the opposite side. Where does the truth lie? I don't know. A lot of people, I think, would say if I lost my job because of misconduct, you know, at my radio station or as a teacher, could I rightfully expect to get paid for it?
Were there things that came out in these documents that you think have been overlooked, stories that in the couple of days since the documents became public haven't been reported on as much?
There were a couple of the cases, I guess, of the individual priest, Daniel Budzinski, that had not been reported on at all, as far as I could tell. And there were some things that in Archbishop Weakland's deposition that I found interesting. He talked about one of the biggest problems he was having in getting rid of these priests was that the statute of limitations on claims was much different for Rome. And he didn't say what it was, but I think it was relatively brief. And also the age was different, that they considered an adult would be a 16-year-old and you know, under state law, it's 18. So he said that he had approached the Pope, and in 1998, he had increased both the length of time that one had to file and the amount of the age of adulthood. So that was one thing that I found kind of interesting. But by and large, I got to say, a lot of it was fairly dull reading. You see a lot of bickering among the lawyers, particularly in the depositions.
Do I understand that there's also some additional news in terms of lawyer fees that's come out recently?
On Friday, last a week ago, the federal court file had contained an updated amount of money that had the archdiocese has to cover everybody's legal fees, and so far in 30 months they have spent $5.3 million. And it's not, and that's just on legal fees. That doesn't have to do with anything else. But they had already, when the lawsuit or when the bankruptcy was filed, Archbishop Listecki had noted that they had already spent $29 million. So we're talking already $34 million. It's not resolved. And frankly, I'm not sure I'd even characterize it as a midway point.
Well, and would you imagine that this revelation about the transferring of the $57 million is going to have some impact on the bankruptcy proceedings?
Oh, definitely. I think the key issues that we can look for in the upcoming days on bankruptcy, there are 570 claimants, a little more than that, I guess. And the archdiocese is trying to have as many of those thrown out as possible. They're challenging the validity of the claims, primarily on the statute of limitation grounds. They're saying they're too old under the current statute to be brought. The other big issue, of course, are the assets. And the lawyers for the claimants try to get as much in the pot as possible. And that goes to the cemetery fund. They had transferred, I think it was $90 million to parishes. And earlier, the Judge Kelly had ruled that money could not be touched. That could be appealed. We don't know what the situation is on that. Also, one of the oddest ones was who owns the Archbishop Cousins Center, the headquarters. You know, I'm sure that's a question that's going to come up. Right now, it seems as if the other thing is that the defense of the archdiocese is taking is that times were different back then. We everybody, you know, did it differently, or that the common acceptance was that this was a moral problem, but not that these people could not return to ministry. And that they're saying, and that there was an evolution, and that they came to the realization that it was a real problem much later. The problem with that is that in Weakland's deposition, he talks a little bit about the 1917 Code of Canon Law. And in that, they talk about he talked about how sexual offenses against children was one of the most serious criminal offenses. So it's a little hard to say, well, that exists there, but we really didn't realize that it was a serious problem. But the other thing that I think that jumped out at me in the Weakland deposition particularly was that he said that he never had a complete list of all the offenders. And that struck me as odd. He said that periodically Matt Flynn, his lawyer, would give him a list, but he himself did not have one. And that he also said that he had never turned over a complete list to civil authorities for investigation. By and large, it was not terribly surprising.
Perhaps only in the sheer volume of documents?
I still have not gotten through all of it. And some of it, like I say, is fairly dull going legal documents. I think one of the other things that I found kind of interesting was that Weakland said he was asked if he had talked to Archbishop Cousins about sex abuse. And basically he said, no, I never talked to him about who the offenders were or anything. So he starts the job. Maybe at that point it wasn't a huge – it had not gotten much publicity. But then when Dolan came on board, he also didn't talk to Dolan about it. And, you know, you'd kind of think they would want to share some of their experiences in terms of dealing with this rather than just having, you know, the notes that are in the records. And he also talked – and I think that this is an interesting problem. What do you do with offenders? Weakland had said, well, you know, we handle it better than society in general because we don't toss them out on the street. And there may be some truth there. But on the same token, how did you make sure that your flock is not going to be continued to be endangered by these folks? And I think that's a real problem.
It's an interesting question, and as you say, you know, this long story that's been going on for a couple of decades might only be maybe halfway done.
If that, I'm not sure. I think that one of the things that SNAP has been saying, they have been pressing very hard for the release of all of these documents, sort of a truth and reconciliation process, and we haven't seen that entirely. We've seen a portion of it. Who decided that these are the records, the archdiocese? It was not an outside agency that determined these are the abusers. They don't list the deacons, although there were deacons who were removed. They don't list religious order. I think Isley was saying that he believes that there are probably more than 60, significantly more than what have been released. And one of the documents I read, and I am not quite sure which one it was at this point, but somebody mentioned that Archbishop Martin of Dublin was at Marquette, I think it was about a year or two ago, and he said that the truth has power to free, that half-truths do not. And he was basically calling on the church to come clean. And I honestly don't think that this will ever be over until that occurs. I think he is right on the mark.
Marie Rohde, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Marie Rohde wrote about the release of documents related to the clergy sex abuse scandal for the National Catholic Reporter. She's a former religion reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel as well. You can find a link to her latest stories from WUWM.com. Thanks to WUWM News' Marty Michelson for providing the audio from SNAP's Peter Isley. Former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske has worked with sexual abuse victims in her role in the Restorative Justice Institute at Marquette University. She's with us now to provide some additional perspective. Thanks for being here.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Was there anything that particularly surprised you in the scores of documents that were released this week?
Well, I can't say I read all the documents. Certainly, the amount of the documentation, I think, is surprising. But most of the things that people are talking about or I've had a chance to look at, I think we've heard one way or another in the past, and it's just the volumes and volumes that have been made accessible to the public that's shocking.
I wonder if, taken in their entirety, these do anything to sway anybody on either side of the divide.
I doubt it. I think that most people have heard of not only the sexual assaults, but also the moving. If people take the time to read the actual allegations, it may shock some people with the details and exactly what was going on, because I think people have sometimes a different perception of what the nature of the assaults were. But I think it makes a difference for the victims and survivors and their families that the public can know what happened to them and why it is that they can't, quote unquote, just get over it.
Well, and so there is the question. Would you expect that the lasting impact of these documents will be along those lines that you were just saying in the context of what the victims of sexual abuse have been through?
Well, there are a couple of things. We have found around the world that one of the ways to work toward healing of victims is to let people hear the truth, whether it's the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings in South Africa or whether there are other mechanisms to archive information, but to let people know exactly what happened to understand it. And so I think that piece is important. It's also important that these victims often weren't believed, and now people can read and understand why that hurt them so badly. And thirdly, I think it's important because we know that there are other victims and survivors out in the community that have not reported the abuse. And if they go to read those reports, they will know they were not alone. And perhaps even they will see the name of their abuser amongst the files that have already been made public.
Well, what about the idea of opening old wounds? You were, say, a survivor of a sexual assault or a sexual abuse case. Does this potentially make you feel worse about what you've been through?
Well, everybody's different, and certainly that's a possibility. But I could tell you, since I work with survivors of violent crime all the time, their response generally is, he or they can't hurt me any more than they already have. I want people to know the truth of what happened. And so I'm sure there are people that, you know, have tried to put it aside and would rather not have it in the newspaper. But I can tell you there are just as many people that have some sense of relief that the public can know what happened.
Is there any additional legal exposure to the church from what you have read?
Well, I think, as I understand it, and I don't know all the details of the bankruptcy, I don't know that there's additional legal exposure, but there's still this question of the trust, the cemetery trust, and whether or not that is subject to collection and division by the victims. And the court's going to have to go through that and make its decision. But I think in terms of liability, it's pretty clear at this point, and particularly since they're going through bankruptcy, it's a matter of whether the claim is substantiated and then how much can the archdiocese have to be able to pay out and how much are the insurance companies going to pay out.
Would you imagine there is ever a point at which there is closure in this case for the victims or even for the church?
Again, I take my lead from the survivors of crime that I talk to. They will say there's no such thing as closure when something traumatic like that has happened to you. There's healing, and they call it an ING word, because some days it's better and some days it's not. I think it's a path, a journey of healing, a journey of moving on, and a journey of seeing that something good is coming out of the bad. And I think there's a deep desire by many victims to say, I want to make sure this doesn't happen to anybody else. I want to make sure that everybody knows what happened here so that we can prevent it for future victims or future children. And so certainly it helps survivors go on their recovery journey, but there's never a closure of this on this kind of an offense.
There is a lot of difficult material in these documents, but on the whole, do you look at their release as a positive development?
I do. And I, having worked with a lot of victims, they've been working towards this for a long time. One of the things that really disturb the survivors of clergy abuse that unlike other victims, when things were reported, there is often a criminal charge and there's a trial and there's a criminal complaint. And of course, none of that happened in most of these cases. And so it was covered up or never exposed. And they have some need to have that known, what happened to them, in part so it doesn't happen to others, but also to be reaffirmed that they did not deserve this. This is something that was done to them by people in positions of power, and they need community strength and power to help them in their healing.
Janine Geske, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Janine Geske is a former Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice and now a distinguished professor of law and head of the Restorative Justice Institute at Marquette University. Stay tuned. There's more of Lake Effect in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The imminent Independence Day holiday is another milepost in the annual gardener's calendar. You might be seeing the first fruits of your labors, either of the flower or the edible variety. Melinda Myers is our gardening contributor, and she's with us to talk about the balance between beauty and abundance. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mitch. It's always great to be here.
Before we get to talking about gardens, let's talk about talking about gardens for just a minute. You recently won a pretty major communications award from, is it the American Horticultural Society?
You bet. And it recognizes professionals in various areas. And the Communication Award recognizes my work through different media, teaching, lecturing, radio and television, and nice folks like you that give me the opportunity to reach gardeners via radio, which is very efficient, but also has that nice personal touch, I think.
Well, and it strikes me that we have never actually sat down and talked about how this became a big part of who you are. I mean, you have worked in the garden probably as long as you've been able to talk, but when did the communicating of what you do become such a key part of the equation for you?
You know, I started as an extension with Extension, which is the outreach arm of the university, of the UW system here in Wisconsin. And part of my job was to teach homeowners. I started the Master Gardener program here in Milwaukee County, talking to professionals and communities about gardening, about beautification, community gardening. And so I had the opportunity to reach a lot of people. Well, being an extension agent, the media often comes if there's a drought or a flood or, you know, the winds damage trees, and they come and interview you and ask questions. And so through that, I had an opportunity to start writing for the newspaper, doing radio and TV interviews. And as my career grew and changed, my opportunities with the media did the same. And I look at doing TV, radio, the newspaper as just a different classroom. You know, this is my way of reaching a lot of people efficiently, but having that touch, because so many people are excited about gardening. Some are brand new, so this is a new mystery to them. And some gardeners have been doing it a long time, but every year is different in Wisconsin and every season is different. And so the challenges really can add some, I think, excitement to gardening. Sometimes a little too much challenge for some of us, but I think it's great because we get to learn every season something new. And my job, I feel, is to help share what I've learned along the way, what gardeners share with me, and pass it on. And so one of the things I like is I love the applied science of horticulture. But as you can tell, I like to talk to people. So I've been able to put the two together through this career, first as an extension agent, as an assistant city forester, as a technical college teacher, now on my own, working with folks like you.
Well, and do you see is the key challenge in managing the message, I mean, tailoring the message to whatever level that you're speaking to?
I think so, and I think sharing the passion, you know. And I'm very practical. I think I'm like everybody else. I'm busy. I have a longer list than time available. I have delusions of grandeur every spring. I'm going to get those plants in the ground and my garden's going to be bigger. And I end up in the same place so many of us do, with a few weeds to manage, which I have right now. And, you know, it's the rain. It's the rain. But, you know, we always have those challenges. And so one of the things I like to share are practical ways to resolve the problems, things that work for me. You know I'm not unique. We're all busy. We all want to have a beautiful landscape, but we don't have as much time as we want, most of us. And so I like to pass on practical solutions and also make people feel okay. You know, we all fail. We all kill plants. And anyone that denies that has not been gardening, is all I got to say, or they lie very well. So it's part of the process of learning.
Well, speaking of management, we're going to talk for a few minutes today about managing gardens and landscapes for both beauty and productivity. And that's a key part of the paradigm that is the paradigm for many of us. Let's talk about, first of all, whether these are mutually exclusive terms. Can something be both beautiful and productive?
It definitely can. And part of it is the right plant in the right location. And we often, all of us, try new plants that are out on the market, and they really do great. And sometimes they do too well. I think you were sharing that you have a Russian sage.
Yeah, that's an excellent example. We bought these Russian sage to add to our landscape, and they were beautiful for a while. And then they became productive. And I'm not sure having Russian sage crowding out our driveway necessarily qualifies as beauty. It certainly quantifies.
Yes.
So let's take that as an example. You know, what should we do when things start getting out of control?
Well, some of the things you can do are manage the plants differently. So with Russian sage, for example, they do send out runners for many gardeners. So you can go out with a sharp shovel and disconnect and kind of try to keep it contained. For many gardeners, Russian sage gets floppy. And especially as it gets older, if it's in shade, or for those gardening in heavy soils that are really nutrient-rich, tends to flop. Cut it back at the end of the winter to 4 to 6 inches. Even if it survives 3 feet high, cut it back. Then if it still flops, in mid-June, cut it back halfway. And that will help to keep it more compact. Then the other thing that you can do is remove it and compost it if you can't find someone with more room that would like to adopt your plant. And sometimes people look at me like, you're really saying compost that plant? You know, it's a different form that you're putting the plant back in the garden. You're not wasting it. You're not throwing it away. You're composting it, so it's going to add something to your garden. And the nice thing about perennials, you can dig and move them. You can dig and share them. And you can compost them. Trees and shrubs are a bigger expense and not so easy to move. So those are things that we really want to definitely take some time, because you can manage the size, but it's a lot of work. You have a lot of yard waste to manage then. You know, what are you going to do with all that brush? And keeping a 40-foot tree down to 20 is really difficult and not good for the plant. So we can have productive, meaning full and vigorous, or in the case of fruits and vegetables, lots of edible fruits, lots of edible vegetables.
Well, and so let's talk about the edible part of this equation. What about the idea of managing edible things to be both productive and attractive?
You know, back in the late 70s when I started my career, a lot of people were gardening in containers and in their front yards. So you put a vegetable garden in the front yard, a little more acceptable now, but, you know, depending on where you live, your neighbors might think you're crazy.
A little bohemian.
A little bohemian, exactly. The good news is a lot of breeders are developing compact varieties, things with colorful fruit that are much easier to blend in with flowers, and lots of colorful trellises. So those cucumbers, instead of wandering all over the yard, put them on a really nice obelisk. Train them up and it looks really nice and beautiful and productive. You also will get better production from your vegetables with regular harvesting, and they'll look better. So if you continue to pick your zucchini when they're 6 inches long instead of baseball bat size, you'll get more zucchini and it looks better. You know, they'll be colorful, they'll look good, and you won't have your neighbors running from you when you come to the door with a big baseball bat zucchini. So it's kind of in that design. And a lot of what I like to talk about are flavorful landscapes, looking at substitution. So if you're looking for something to make, say, jams and jellies, some of the new elderberries are beautiful. So they're nice, attractive shrubs. You can harvest the fruit if you can beat the birds to them, and use it instead of, say, a viburnum that you couldn't use that, or the Japanese maple that won't survive very easily in Wisconsin. How about a black lace elderberry? So we can look at doing substitutions. Raspberries can be a little overwhelming, but can you think of any better barrier plant? If you'd want to get somebody to stop cutting through your grass, put a stand of raspberries there, and they won't be using that as their shortcut anymore.
Can you eat Russian sage?
Not that I know, but it smells good when you prune it. So I think we're going to have to maybe look at either doing a little severe root pruning or a little composting in your case.
It's a deal. Melinda Myers, thanks.
Thank you, Mitch.
The award-winning Melinda Myers has written numerous books on gardening, leads regular walks at Berner Botanical Gardens, and has a new series of DVDs on gardening called How to Grow Anything. She's also our regular gardening contributor, and you can find links to much more about her from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. We'll take a break and then continue our look at the role of Wisconsin soldiers at the Battle of Gettysburg when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. This week, we've revisited our Iron Brigade and Beyond series and the story of Wisconsin soldiers fighting in one of the Civil War's most famous and deadliest battles, Gettysburg, 150 years ago this week. The 2nd, 6th, and 7th Wisconsin regiments were part of the noted Iron Brigade, along with regiments from Indiana and Michigan. They played a key role in defending Union positions on the first day of battle, July 1, 1863. Such was their bravery that at the end of the day, the Iron Brigade had to be ordered off the field, but that courage cost them dearly. The voice of our Iron Brigade series, Pewaukee historian Thomas Martin Sabatke, tells us the deadly toll they paid that first day and their role in the days of battle to come.
When they get up on the hills above Gettysburg in the darkness at the end of the day, regiments are really quite reduced. The 2nd Wisconsin went in with 302 men. They took 72% casualties. The 6th Wisconsin lost about 60%, over half its men, mainly at the railroad cut, but some additional men later at the seminary and so forth. The 19th Indiana was somewhat less damaged. It escaped some of the serious fighting because in the early morning fight, they had simply outflanked the enemy and hadn't had to do much real hard fighting in that. They simply did what was necessary to ensure that first victory in that fight. But up on Culp's Hill, which is next to Cemetery Hill, if you ever visit Gettysburg, the brigade front, that is the frontage they gave them to defend, was way smaller than what their brigade front should be. Why? Every man in the dark as they dug little trenches with their bayonets, their tin cups, whatever they could get, knew why. A lot of their brothers were lying on the field dead or wounded or they were captured. It had been a horrendous day. The 24th Michigan lost half or more of its men. Horrible casualties. And if there were a few guys that still thought the 24th weren't quite as good as the other regiments, you're not going to hear anybody ever say that again. What is important about that is that you're going to have two more days of fighting at Gettysburg, which we all know in American history is one of the great turning point battles of the Civil War. The Army of the Potomac had to win that fight. That was simply as that. If they're going to win the war, they had to win that fight. What the men from Wisconsin, Michigan, and Indiana had done that day in three different bitter fights that by themselves would have been more than enough for a big battle for a typical unit. They had sacrificed themselves for their country. They had saved the Union. They made it possible for that Union Army to hold the best ground for the next 2 days' fighting. And Confederates would comment on it after the war. You know, those Yankees had the best damn ground of the war there. Who had won the right for that? Who had held that ground long enough, had helped the units on either side of them be stout enough to make sure that when night fell, they had the high ground? Largely, it was the Iron Brigade. And it's largely forgotten by most Americans today. And these are people from Wisconsin, largely. The Iron Brigade was so decimated. Actually, it was more than decimated because, of course, under Roman terms in ancient times, that's 10% casualties. And when you have 40, 50, 60, 70% casualties, you're more than decimated. They were up on Culp's Hill for the last 2 days of the fight. The 6th Wisconsin, led by Rufus Dawes, did help repel a real key Confederate thrust at taking the hill from the lower end in the darkness on the second day's fighting and were very instrumental in turning that back. But we don't hear that much from Wisconsin men in the second 2 days because the third and fifth Wisconsin were separated into brigades that were dominated by regiments from other states, and they didn't play as prominent a role. But any Wisconsin soldier that was at Gettysburg was involved. Battery B, 4th United States Artillery, by this time had a number of Iron Brigade soldiers in it, some of them from Wisconsin, and they were up by the Evergreen Cemetery, the town cemetery on Cemetery Hill, and they got involved in a heavy artillery exchange with very well-served guns on a place called Brenner's Hill, and the idea was to dismount all of the federal guns and then make the assault on the hill. And the Confederates initially had some success. They even had a caisson, an ammunition wagon, blown to bits from Battery B. They really took it some heavy damage, but they returned the fire very accurately as part of the federal what's called counter-battery fire. It's to us, it would be you get shot at by artillery and your artillery will shoot back at their artillery and to make them stop. And that did happen. The federal artillery was that good. But we don't hear that much about the Wisconsin soldiers the last 2 days. And even after the war and even into our own time, the big reason, I think, is that we're not the center here in Wisconsin of America's media empire then or now. We're kind of a flyover state. In the 1880s, Rufus Dawes and some of the members of the 6th Wisconsin and some of the other Iron Brigade soldiers got into a bit of a dispute with veterans from New York who had also fought bravely and were a real central part of the first day at Gettysburg. But they were shoved aside, and there was a lot of bad feeling about that, you know, having their sacrifice not fully recognized. And there is this bit of animus between Easterners, people on the eastern seaboard, New England on down to the mid-Atlantic states, and those of us out here. We're Westerners. That's the one thing I want to get our listeners to excited about, is that during the Civil War, we're those tough, crusty Westerners who know how to shoot, can chew our tobacco and hold our whiskey and all this kind of stuff. And we're tough in battle. And these refined Easterners kind of looked askance at us. These other things that happen are legitimate things. The great fighting over Little Round Top, which was so highlighted in a 1990s film, Gettysburg. And, of course, no one forgets the climactic third day of Pickett's Charge and Cemetery Ridge. But Frank Haskell, who was an aide to John Gibbon, who was by the time of Gettysburg, not commanding the Iron Brigade anymore, but he had his a whole division on Cemetery Ridge. He was there, and he was at the center of Pickett's Charge. And Frank Haskell, actually, from Wisconsin, from this area right here, I'm trying to remember if he was from Milwaukee even, was instrumental first in guiding in some Union regiments on the third day when officers that normally would have done that for him, he was just an aide to the general, were down. And he wrote, of course, a superb account of Gettysburg. I recommend, as classic Civil War literature, reading Frank Haskell's account. Unfortunately, he was killed in the Overland Campaign in 1864. But I think Gettysburg, there's a tendency to forget the sacrifice that was made on the first day. Lee would have had no problem sweeping aside the Army of the Potomac and sending them toward Washington if the high ground beyond the town had not been guaranteed by the blood of the Iron Brigade on July 1st, 1863, the first day of Gettysburg. It seems like we in Wisconsin get to do all the unglamorous work, and all this great glory goes to these other regiments, and rightly so. But people kind of forget that there wouldn't have been a second and third day at Gettysburg without what the Iron Brigade did there.
Thomas Martin Sobotky is the voice of the Civil War series Iron Brigade and Beyond. He's a historian, teacher, and author of the novel Richmond's Bloody Road under the name Thomas Martin Saturday. He's also the author of Across That Dark River, The Civil War Memory. One last break, and then we'll explore some of the best trails Wisconsin has to offer, no matter how you take them. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. Many of us have a long weekend coming up, starting maybe after work today. And if the weather holds, some of us will be heading outdoors to walk, bike, run, or maybe rollerblade. The cover story in this month's Milwaukee Magazine gives us a profile of some of the best trails in the Milwaukee metro area. Writer Tom Held chose 35 of his favorites, a list that is geographically diverse and offers something for all skill levels. He tells Lake Effect's Bonnie North people may be surprised at how long trails have been an important part of life here.
Well, you could go back to 1901 if you really want to be a historian on this. That's when the state legislature authorized counties to build side paths along roads for bicycles. And so, yeah, Wisconsin has been out front on this for a long time. The Elroy Sparta Trail, much beloved trail, opened in 1967 and is regarded as one of the first two rails-to-trails conversions in the entire country. There's a little dispute over that with a trail in Illinois. But as I said, that opened in 1967, and Wisconsin right now ranks third in the country in the total miles, over 2,000 miles of rail corridors that have been converted into multi-use trails for biking, for rollerblading, for roller skiing, for hiking, running, whatever
kind of— And that's statewide?
That's statewide, right.
Okay.
I came up with 315 miles of trails, say, within an hour's drive of Milwaukee, some of those within, you know, just outside your back door or front door. I would say that that's comprehensive but not exhaustive. As I was doing the research on this, I kept finding new trails, trails that I didn't know existed, small little 3 to 5 mile segments that are run by municipalities from Burlington to Muskego. And then you have the big ones, the Interurban Trail up in Ozaukee County, the Hank Aaron State Trail, the Glacial Drumlin nearby here, and the Lake Country Trail, and a number of others out in Waukesha County.
It sounds like not all of them are rail-to-trail conversions, that they are actually purpose-built to do exactly that, to provide a space for walkers and bikers and you know, rollerbladers, that sort of thing.
Right. Either rail corridors or utility corridors. We Energies, the Interurban Trail in Ozaukee County, that started as a rail corridor but then became a utility corridor for We Energies. So having that long stretch of linear property is a real advantage. Right now, the challenge is to try to link those. You're finding that in the Oak Leaf Trail, trying to connect those off-street segments in a fashion that keeps people safe and enjoying that. And you don't have a 10-mile rail corridor left off of Hampton Avenue to build the next extension. So that kind of slows the process and makes it more difficult.
So as you were doing the research and finding all of these trails, most of them sound like they've been built in the last 40 or 50 years
right.
or so.
Yes.
What are some of the challenges that people are finding to either keeping them functioning and able to be used, or building new ones and building these connectors?
Well, property acquisition is a big one. You know, it costs a lot of money. The section that the Milwaukee County wants to build, essentially from Estabrook Park to Mill Road, which would then tie together from Milwaukee's lakefront, from Veterans Park and Bradford Beach, all the way to Brown Deer Road and then the Interurban Trail up to Port Washington and Sheboygan. You have about 3 miles there that's going to cost $3.5 million. And most of that is the property acquisition of that short little section of railroad. So that's where the challenge is. And, you know, funding for bike trails right now is getting tighter and tighter. There's not a strong political will to spend that kind of money, even though it's, you know, a minuscule portion of the state transportation budget.
In terms of ownership of the trails, are these all owned by municipalities or by the state or by nonprofit organizations? Yes to all or?
Yes to all.
Okay, so it's kind of a mix of like who actually has jurisdiction over this
right,
stuff?
Right, right. The Hank Aaron State Trail is the property of the Department of Natural Resources, but the construction of that was tied in with the reconstruction of Canal Street. So you have a lot of city dollars in that. You have stewardship funds because that was also part of a revitalization of the Menominee River. You have now the Three Bridges Park, which will open officially July 20th, which is part of the Hank Aaron State Trail. And you've had a lot of private dollars going into that. So I think for people who are looking to build trails or maintain trails, they'll take money wherever they can get it.
So that can, though, make things difficult when it comes time to repairing or if there's a problem, who actually goes and fixes it?
Right. I think that's definitely the case. People do complain about the Oak Leaf Trail and you ride on that. I ride on that. And there are some segments that definitely need improving. And the folks in the Milwaukee County Parks Department, which manages and maintains that, would say the same thing. They're doing the best they can with the dollars available. But there are sections that where the pavement is full of potholes and people get nervous about riding on it. I think one other element that really could be improved on the entire system is the mapping and the signage. If you're not familiar with a couple of sections of trail, the Oak Leaf, the Hank Aaron State Trail, and then the New Berlin Rec Trail is another good example, you would just kind of get lost. They just sort of dump you out onto a city street with some signage, but not the kind that I think most users would appreciate or want.
So let's talk about some of these trails.
Yeah.
You don't – obviously, it's not an exhaustive list, but there are quite a few good ones on here. You mentioned the Hank Aaron State Trail, which I've actually ridden on. It's a lot of fun to do because it takes you down through that old industrial corridor, and you see a lot of things that you don't normally think of when you go out on a bike.
Right. And one of the things that I really like is that section through the Veterans Administration grounds, those historic buildings on there. I think most people would never get that experience. Get to see that and appreciate that without riding or walking on that Hank Aaron State Trail.
What are some of the other ones, as you were doing the research, that you found that you thought, huh, I didn't know that one was here? And then have you ridden any of them since you did the story?
A few of them. I would have to say the one that stands out for me and has since I've written the story was the White River State Trail in Burlington. That was a gem. It was a good find for me. I had heard about it. Didn't know where it was, what it was, and got to ride down there on a beautiful Sunday afternoon. And it's about 12 miles long, crushed gravel. I kind of like riding on crushed gravel, and you could ride that on a road bike. It's a firm surface. Mm-hmm. And you're close to Lake Geneva, you know, beautiful countryside. And then there's a little bike shop and a cafe called the Pedal and Cup, which is at about the halfway point. And they have music on Sunday afternoons. And that to me would be a place I'd like to take my girls sometime. I think it would be a really good family outing to hang out, listen to some music, and maybe ride a half mile or so.
Well, in the article, it's not just bike trails or walking trails. You also break it out into hiking trails and mountain biking trails as
right.
well. So let's talk about some of the hiking trails. I think a lot of people might not think that there are any too close of real hiking to Milwaukee, but that doesn't seem to be true.
Oh, no. The Lion's Den Gorge up in Ozaukee County is just spectacular. The bluffs there. I've been utilizing the Ice Age Trail for probably more than a decade. And I think that's another one of those gems that people just don't appreciate. We're within an hour's drive of access points In the northern Kettle Moraine State Forest, up around Plymouth and close to Slinger, and then down in the southern Kettle Moraine Forest, close to Whitewater and LaGrange and those areas. And that is true hiking. I talk to people about that who have hiked around the country, the Appalachian State Trail, and I think it stacks up very nicely with that. Parnell Tower in the Plymouth area, what a treat. They have a 3.2-mile hiking trail there, and that will test you.
That's real hiking.
That's real hiking.
And what about mountain biking?
Wisconsin, again, is way probably underrated to an extent. Close by, the trails in the southern Kettle Moraine State Forest, where they're called the John Muir Trails, just about 9 miles east of Whitewater, are some of the best in the state. They have over 30 miles of trails, and volunteers have been out there for the last decade and really improved those. That is top of the line mountain biking, and within a reasonable drive, I can get there door to door in an hour, 10 minutes with a stop at the Elegant Farmer. And when you go there on a Saturday afternoon, we're bringing in some tourist dollars because those folks from Illinois are packing that place.
What about what's coming along? Are there trails being built? You'd said before that money is tight now for this kind of thing, but are there still things in the works?
There are some things in the works. As I mentioned, the extension of the Oak Leaf Trail, and that's going to be just about a 3.5-mile connection from Estabrook Park up to basically Brown Deer Park in that Mill Road area. And that's going to provide an off-street link. I just think that that's going to be a huge improvement for the Oak Leaf, and people are going to be able to ride from Milwaukee's lakefront all the way up to Port Washington and then on to Sheboygan almost entirely, at least 90% off street on a 10-foot wide paved path. I think that's going to be exceptional. One other one that I think is going to have a big impact, and it's sort of a street, you talked about commuters, the KK River Trail. From basically Maple Avenue on 1st Street in Kinnickinnick to Washington Boulevard is now an off-street path through an old industrial area. And then next year they are going to rebuild South Water Street through that industrial corridor. And when they do that and put in a bike lane, that is going to provide a very much improved route for people in the Bayview neighborhood and those South Side neighborhoods, even Cudahy and St. Francis, to downtown Milwaukee. Anecdotally, I live in that neighborhood. I talk to people all the time and they're saying, wow, look at all those people on bikes, you know, in the morning. That has picked up dramatically. I don't know that anyone has done the specific counts on it, but I think you can see that. And I think that's going to really help continue that expansion, getting more people out on bikes for commuting.
Well, Tom, thanks so much.
All right.
Tom Held produces the Active Pursuit blog and writes about endurance sports for OnMilwaukee.com and other local magazines. His article on the best trails is the cover story of the July issue of Milwaukee Magazine. That's Wednesday's Lake Effect. We'll take a break for the 4th of July holiday tomorrow so we can bring you the musical political satire of the Capitol Steps. But we'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Mitch Tyke. Enjoy the Independence Day holiday. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and I hope you'll be with us again Friday and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.